Well, whenever I teach, I engage in a practice which is probably inspired ultimately by the Quakers, which is to ask that we sit silently for a moment as we begin, in an effort just to try to release some of the other noises, turn off some of the other noises and burdens and concerns we might be carrying, and to bring our spirits more fully to this place. So let's just kind of settle ourselves in by sitting together in silence for a moment, and then I'll begin. Okay, let's roll the tape. My name's Dorothy Bass. I'm a church history professor, and this week I've been doing a series at Holden trying to lift up some of the various traditions within the Christian tradition and to see what we can learn from them. Holden's probably predominantly Lutheran, but a lot of us from other traditions find our way here. I'm a minister in the United Church of Christ, and I imagine that we have a different assortment of people here. The Quakers, or who call themselves always the Society of Friends, though I understand it's not offensive to say Quaker. Quaker, the name given them by others, because in their religious ecstasy in the early years, they trembled in the presence of God. Society of Friends, Friends of God, Friends of Humankind, are the tradition I want to highlight tonight. And this is a tradition I've always found just tremendously exciting, and from which I think we have a lot to learn, which also, I think, lifts up the theme of Holden this year, in the image of God. Because there's probably not another group of Christians that has tried as consistently to enact in its practices and its beliefs the idea that all persons are in the image of God, and to develop forms of worship, forms of communal life, and approaches to society which lift up that one insight, which all Christians share, but which this group particularly lifts up. I think we know them as having a form of spirituality that's gentle and quiet, and admired from afar by many of us, but also have made many contributions for social justice and peace, and have spurred other Americans and other people in the lands where Quakers are on to seek justice and peace more fully. You're welcome to come in. Come along. We have enough.
Thank you, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. We want everybody to be welcome. Let me ask, first of all, if we have any friends in attendance, just so you can share your wisdom with us later, the two of you. Great. Is this your first trip to Holden?
Fourth.
Yeah. All right.
We don't mind losing.
Good. No, I don't either. Great. Great. Well, later on, I really hope you'll share. I'm not of this tradition myself, and I hope I can be fair to it. My plan is to depict some of the history from which it came, because as a historian, I believe that's how you really understand things, to try to hold up some of the classic central beliefs and practices, and to leave discussion for those. But then also, before we finish, I want to share with you the testimony of probably my favorite Quaker, John Woolman, who had insights into the American experience in which Native Americans, African Americans, and English settlers were living and sowing the seeds of our future destruction, he said, and who had a spiritual approach to that, a theological approach to that, which I think is very inspiring, and which I've always wanted to share with people at Holden. So I want to begin with some brief history and some characteristics. We'll discuss those, and then I'll move on to John Woolman's spirituality and testimony. today there are approximately 125,000 members of the Society of Friends in the United States, divided into a number of groups which are somewhat different among themselves in their worship style and theology and some of their witnesses. And we can define some of that later, but let me try to lay out, first of all, some of the classic early tradition. The Society of Friends arose in England in the middle of the 1600s, in a period of tremendous social and religious and political turmoil. Now, you may remember some of this from your old high school or college history classes, maybe you don't, but in the 1640s, the English had a civil war, some people call it a revolution, okay, in which the rights of the people were being expressed over against those of the king. It resulted by, in 1649, after a war which the Catholic king lost in the beheading of the king, which was a tremendously radical thing for a society which thought that the king represented the state. Okay, this is Oliver Cromwell, you may remember that. But in that context of dispute, and Protestantism had fueled some of the democratic sentiment, and the people who were fighting against the hierarchy were of strong Protestant persuasion, mostly of the Calvinistic variety, Presbyterians, okay, influenced by John Calvin. But what's important is that in the midst of that political turmoil, this raised expectation about the equality of persons, the freedom of persons, and in the midst of that turmoil over what is Christianity and the Protestant witness of the priesthood of all believers, of the autonomy of the individual in believing, taking away the Pope in between, taking away the priests, all of us are priests, that some of these Protestant ideas of Christian freedom, political ideas of political freedom, made for a lot of turmoil, which was kind of religious, kind of political. And in that context, a number of short-lived but very radical Christian movements formed, 1640s in England. One of them was called the Levelers. Okay? Level the society. All persons are equal. Vote for everyone. Land for everyone. As a Christian principle. The Diggers. Those were another one. Do you remember in Haight-Ashbury in the hippie days, the people who gave out free clothing and food in San Francisco were called Diggers? Well, the Diggers in Revolutionary England were the ones who thought that all the common land, the king's land, should be given to the people. The Fifth Monarchy group, which expected the king, which is a revelation type apocalyptic term, expecting the kingdom of God to come at any moment. Okay? So all of this expectation was on. There's another group called the Ranters, and nobody knows what they said anymore, but you call them the Ranters. Okay? The popular religious preachers going around in a revolutionary situation. And there were some sensitive souls who believed this, the promise of freedom and equality which was there, but who were very troubled at the competing claims of all these different groups who claimed to have the absolute truth. And these people came to be known as seekers. This is still a very honorable position to hold within the Christian faith, to be a seeker, to go from one to another and say, tell me the word of truth, and to try to look in all these different groups. And there were a number of seekers, but one of them was named George Fox, and he became ultimately the founder of the Quakers. He was a worker, a weaver, a shoemaker, something like this.
I didn't write. He was a worker in leather.
A worker in leather. Okay, I didn't write this down, but a working class person. He was literate, who went around to the different groups and was very troubled by the competing claims. And then in the midst of this, had a mystical experience. Let me quote what he said. And when all my hopes in them, in all the different sectarian movements, and in all men were gone, so that I had nothing outwardly to help me, nor could tell what to do, then, oh then, I heard a voice which said, there is one, even Christ Jesus, that can speak to thy condition. Now, all Christians would say Christ can speak to your condition, but he meant inwardly. All outward had failed him. All the preachers had failed him. All the churches had failed him. Christ would speak directly within his heart. Okay? and joining together with other seekers and calling them to this idea of hearing directly the voice of Christ within ourselves. They develop forms of worship which involve sitting in silence and trying to turn down the other messages, trying to become free of the things that we believe in the world, and listen clearly for the voice of Christ speaking within, and then to share that with one another. And in that sharing, to develop a community of people who respected one another as bearing the voice of Christ, bearing really Christ within them, within their own hearts. He thought that this was available directly to everyone, whether the person knew it or not. Okay, that it was there in all of you, all of us were, non-Quakers were saved too. I mean, that it was there, but that to become properly Christian and in touch with God meant to silence some of the other impulses in our lives and to listen to Christ. So traveling around in England in this period of turmoil and probably some disillusion, okay, high hopes for freedom and equality, but disillusion. After all, there was war, poverty, hurt. A community gathered around this message. But Fox was imprisoned, beaten, whipped, punished for carrying this message. Why would this be such a threatening message? We're talking about poor people standing, yes.
Mm-hmm. Takes away authority.
Right. The idea that there's somebody who can tell us about God up there, right, and what's right and wrong, it puts this, yeah. And we're talking about, street preachers who would look like unruly folks standing, saying, I have the voice of Christ. Listen to me.
Right, because what happens is it turns authority over to each individual mm-hmm. person. And once they become that way as on an individual spiritual level, then that could reflect in a social way and a political way. And then you've got absolute turmoil in some mm-hmm. countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's chaotic.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Right.
Could be wonderful, but it could be.
Yeah.
For those in power, it's chaotic.
Yeah, right. Now, they expected that what Christ told them in their hearts would be something like, would be the same thing that you get in the Bible. But if it came to a choice, maybe you haven't read the Bible correctly yet. Okay. So there's a possibility of continuing revelation of new truth coming forward, which also can break things open. Okay. And a lot of the assumptions would be shattered. And there was also a lot of poor people who were involved in this and who believed themselves to be empowered. Okay. Well, in 1652, after Fox had been preaching for 3 or 4 years, it came a meeting in which some people of higher station were also converted, and a base of operations and a budget and sort of thing became available. This was Judge Fell and his wife Margaret Fell, who were owners of Swarthmore Hall. Now there's a Quaker college now called Swarthmore. And from this base, better organization and more people were recruited and so on. And Margaret Fell after Judge Fell died, Margaret Fell would marry George Fox. Strong missionary impulse, a strong belief that they had the truth and that if it could be shared with others, that what they were talking about was the coming of the kingdom of God, overcoming the restraints of the fallen world, and actually all persons living as in Christ, and that this their great high hopes of fulfilling the promise of the kingdom of God in that. Now, some of the distinctive marks of these early Quakers, which persisted in many Quaker communities for a long time, and some of them still do, were as they tried to develop a life as a community. In a sense, that orders their individualism among themselves, although it still looks scary to the people outside, but among themselves they held themselves to very high standards as of what they thought was right in a community, so not just individuals. That I would see all of these as trying to be ways of showing in a community that I honor the Christ in you, you honor the Christ in me. Okay, treating each, giving each person the opportunity, in a sense, to represent Christ in the community. So that there's no need for a clergy, a special clergy in the early Quaker movement. Okay? And especially they called it a hireling ministry, which is kind of a critique to those who make their living preaching the word, which all of us should be doing. Right? It's a job for some of us. And that seemed to them to be scandalous. So all persons carry that ministry and speak as of Christ. There's no need for an educated, trained, specially elevated clergy, especially. The worship style of sitting in silence and different people who were prompted by the Spirit to stand up and speak. Women were equal as speakers, as having the Spirit of Christ right from the beginning. Okay, never any question about that. And there were always an insistence that within each group of Quakers there would be women's leadership team, in a sense, and a men's leadership team. They called their groups not churches, okay, but meetings. Meetings where the friends came together, and that still is characteristic. The church is a spiritual reality. Okay? The church is the people of God. The church exists in the hearts of those who are one with Christ. And to call the group the church is wrong, but especially to call the building the church is wrong. So if they would walk past Lutheran church, they weren't in England, but you know, an Episcopal church, they would say, that's a steeple house. And their own buildings, when they finally later built buildings, were meeting houses, not churches. Okay? Because there's always, you heard this in George Fox's, nothing outwardly would help me. There's always a quest for the inward truth, not the outward truth. There's a suspicion of the things which we do with physical elements, almost the opposite of Roman Catholicism, which is very sacramental, and where you do experience God through the senses and the elements and the smells and the physical things. That in this tradition, there's an effort to get down to the spiritual truth at the center, the inward truth, not the outward. So the sacraments are abolished. But as they would say, not abolished, the physical sacraments were abolished. Okay? Baptism and communion. Yes, the friends commune, but in their spirits, not with bread and wine. Okay? The baptism referred to in the New Testament, which they would still scrupulously study, would refer to the baptism of the Spirit, not to something with water. And there would be a real kind of ultra-Protestant suspicion of pomp and circumstance, ritual, okay, an effort to get down to that, just that kernel of what's in your heart. So it comes out in worship in this way. A real suspicion of anything that might seem idolatrous, okay, like bread and wine, taken as body and blood. Really. A strong emphasis on community of mutual respect and discipline, governed by consensus. There can't be a hierarchy here. There can't be a boss to say, we're going to do it this way. There had to be a consensus of the people. And that consensus is one of the gifts, I think, to later peace movements and so on. Now that's kind of among themselves. Some other things which were characteristic of their behavior, both among themselves and to what they would call the world, you could see as a way of treating all persons in the society as if they also bear Christ within them. Okay. So that everyone was addressed, I love this, little language things which show that you're special as this kind of Christian, to address everyone as thee and thou. Okay. Which, so you know, on the streets, thee, thou, which we don't use this anymore in English, but it's like in French where there's tu and vous. It's using tu all the time. It's the familiar, that which children call themselves. It's a simplicity. wearing plain clothing, okay, not being ostentatious or getting caught up in the fashions of the time or the adornment of the body. but wearing plain clothing. Refusing to do things like take off your hat to a superior, which was a symbol in that hierarchical society of deference, saying you're better than I am. Just leave your hat sitting around your head, you know. And things, not using titles, Mr., Mrs., Dr., Reverend. And even today, if you write a letter to a Quaker, you're supposed to write, you know, Dear Parker Palmer, not Dear Dr. Palmer. You know, there's a distrust of titles in this tradition. And also just little things like, you know, the days of the week are named after the Greek gods or the Norwegian gods or all these different gods. They're not gods, right? So we talk about first day, second day, third day, fourth day, rather than using language which seems to implicate us in any form of idolatry. And those are small things, but they would mark you in a sense or show your consciousness to be different from that of the world in a certain way. Now this kind of belief enraged the hierarchs of that society. Okay. This acting out of egalitarianism in social behavior. So that when the missionaries went out, for instance, to Puritan Boston, and I usually argue against stereotypes of the Puritans as stuffy, uptight, hierarchical people, but this time you can keep that stereotype. You know, they'd walk up to the governor, keep their hat on purpose to make a testimony, say, how be thee today, John? You know, and get thrown in jail for violating the code of the hierarchy, you know, of social hierarchy. Little things like that which just enrage the sensibilities of a hierarchical society. But the most important testimony then, and I think persistently, has been the peace testimony. Okay, the testimony, the refusal to take human life, even when threatened, okay, even when one's own life is at stake, to honor one's own life more greatly than that of another. So there's been a constant peace testimony in this tradition, which has engendered, basically, they were very influential in the American colonies in the United States in winning the right of conscientious objection for those in this country. So that's one testimony. Another one is this belief that, you know, even though other religions may be mistaken by their view, that all persons do have Christ within them and you can learn something from them and you should respect them and they should not be coerced at all in their religious belief. So the Quakers were ardent missionaries to share their good news with people, but they also believed in religious liberty, which very few people did at that time. And both of these came, for instance, in the colony of Pennsylvania, which was governed by Quakers at first. Religious liberty was practiced, and the persecuted movements of all over the Western world came to Pennsylvania to live. And Pennsylvania had no militia. Pennsylvania lived on the frontier with the Native Americans, like the other colonies, without any of them having guns. And it worked. So there was a whole colony there for about 80 years or so, which lived by this freedom and by this peacefulness, which was very, very unusual in that time, as it still is. They were the dominant group in early Pennsylvania, but during the period of the French and Indian War and the Revolutionary War, it became too difficult to govern, particularly when under the English crown, in a time of warfare, and also to be pacifist. I mean, can you be the governor of a state at war and be a pacifist? No, you can't. So they withdrew from public life at that time. And since then, the testimony of peace and justice and treating all persons as Christ and so on has been enacted as a relatively small group of committed people in community, bringing that into the public realm through their own testimony, through their own actions, and through, since 1917, organizations such as the American Friends Service Committee, which has both been an important relief organization for refugees, and particularly for refugees of the enemies of our country. They were very active in Vietnam, for instance. And also an advocacy organization for peace and justice. So some of these testimonies are now the testimonies of a small group, or really several small denominations, all of them related to the Quaker movement, which seek to continue that notion of saying in public life what it would mean to treat all persons as if they were in the image of God. In the course of American history, I'll get to this with Woolman, but the Quakers were very important in initiating and sustaining the anti-slavery movement, the women's rights movement. When that started to emerge, Quaker women were ready. They knew how to speak in public. They had been organizing meetings. They believed in the equality of the sexes and had for a long time. Susan B. Anthony was a Quaker. And many of the early feminists in the 19th century were Quakers. In the early mission, I should have said, in the 1650s and 60s, in those early missionary times, some of the really astounding missionary activity was conducted by women. There was a young woman early on, 1651, who was a servant girl who was sent as the apostle to Oxford and Cambridge universities, you know, and would preach to these, and was imprisoned and beaten for that, and then made a pilgrimage to Turkey on foot, where she testified to the Sultan. You know, so there was a long tradition of very courageous missionary women. One of them who was a Massachusetts woman converted to Quakerism, was together with three other Quakers hung on Boston Common in 1660 for their testimony. It was taken to be so socially disruptive. They were deported four or five times. They kept coming back. And finally, the Massachusetts Bay Puritans hung them, and there is a statue of Mary Dyer on that, right in front of Boston, the Massachusetts State House today. So, now, let me stop here, and I'd like to ask our friends over here if you'd like to, most of this is old history more than recent, but I hope it gets to some of the classic themes. Anything you'd like to add, and any questions and so on, I'll just leave time for John Woolman. Okay, so let's get into a general discussion of the movement. Do you want to add anything, or correct anything, or lift up a part that's... a part that's special to you and out of your experience or anything?
Maybe I can say what I think is the... It seems like with most of the Christian traditions I'm familiar with, there's sort of a core of essential ideas that mark that tradition as being maybe not unique, but perhaps as especially exemplifying those ideas. Mm-hmm. I think of Lutherans as exemplifying or sort of honoring justification by faith, for example. Mm-hmm. And Presbyterians as especially honoring the sovereignty of God. Mm-hmm. I think with Quakers, it's the idea of the immediate relationship with Christ. Mm-hmm. That is, that every person has the opportunity to experience Christ directly in an inward way without mediation of clergy or sacraments. Or mm-hmm. Now, I guess the other thing I should say is that there's a great deal of diversity among friends.
Right.
And the classic expression of Quaker worship is the silent meeting, but I think that's probably practiced by a minority of Quakers
today.
That's
true. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a minority of Quakers live in North America and Europe. Most Quakers live in Africa and South America, mm-hmm. and in the Far mm-hmm. East, because right. the Quaker missionary movement has been directed in those areas. And so there are large, well, for example, Vicki and I are members of a meeting in Oregon, which is part of Northwest Yearly Meeting of Friends, which has about 10,000 members. But missionaries from that yearly meeting have gone to Bolivia and Peru, and that yearly meeting now outnumbers us by a factor of 3 or 4. The Quaker movement really has been sort of not explosive in the same way that, say, the Pentecostal movement
right.
in South America has been, or some other movements, but it's been very
And it doesn't have very many of the traditional evidences of East Coast Quakers either, the Bolivian Church.
Yeah, but does it, is it, would it still be pacifist, at least? Not necessarily?
I don't think that would be an issue that they would worry about too much. Uh-huh. They're more concerned with, salvation and survival.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it has, it changes in the mm-hmm. culture.
Mm-hmm. But some of the diversity you'll find among Quakers will be expressed in a manner, in the questions of manner of worship. Mm-hmm. Many of them are. Uh-huh. Sort of meeting. Many Quaker meetings are pastored, uh-huh. and many are not. In Eugene, where we live, there are two Quaker meetings. One is pastored, one is not. Uh-huh. One is a sort of a program service, the other is not.
Right. They're part of different meetings.
They're part of two right. different early meetings
right.
as well.
Right.
Vicki and I came to France from the Presbyterian. Uh-huh. We're both raised Presbyterians. Uh-huh. And the thing that drew us to the Quaker church were two things. In particular, in our particular instance, we were drawn to the particular church because it's an evangelical Quaker church. We suspected it had a high view of Scripture and placed a great deal of importance on the reality of Christ. Mm-hmm. We knew that there were other Quaker congregations that could be fairly mistaken for Unitarians, for mm-hmm. example. So there was that strong emphasis on the high value of Scripture and the person of Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. but also the very evident social expression of their faith.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So those were the sort of twin things that pulled us in.
Mm-hmm.
And but again, those things were carrying
right.
on.
Right.
But consensus is almost, at the business meetings that we have every month, all decisions are decided by consensus,
uh-huh.
which means we move pretty slow sometimes.
Sometimes it takes years to make a decision.
Yeah.
But people don't get mad uh-huh. and go start to the church.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, because it just doesn't, if one person disagrees strongly, that's it. Now, but the person could still disagree and then decide not to disagree.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that's usually how things uh-huh. happen.
Uh-huh.
But it would have to be very clear to the meeting that that person no longer disagrees. And I've seen, you know, that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I misspoke, you know, yeah. I don't, but it's slow.
Yeah, yeah.
We can save something bad, but we can save from making some bad mistakes.
Uh-huh.
We both have a memory of our Presbyterian church in Maryland. We went through a very acrimonious debate and then a vote.
Yeah.
Presbyterians being very sort of Republican in their form. About whether to cut some trees down on church properties. And uh-huh. it really sort of.
It's very passionate issue.
Very passionate. And I can't imagine that happening in our meeting because mm-hmm. that sort of thing would be subjected to a process of consensus in which the whole idea is not that we try to achieve a meeting of minds, but that we all seek the will of God together in the corporate meeting.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Actually, that's a sort of a fundamental thing about Quakers, too. It's not just the inward mm-hmm. individual experience of Christ, but it's also that inward experience is subjected to the confirmation of the whole entire meeting.
Right.
And so that, I think, you know, nationalism of creeds and hierarchies and so forth, that thing, I think, saves Quakers from just really going completely off the wall,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of following whims and fancies and mm-hmm. imaginations. Mm-hmm. Subject those leadings to the confirmation of the body.
Right.
Right, you're technically right. not supposed to go into the room having made your decision about the truth.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you go into the room uh-huh. and then the Holy Spirit guides you
uh-huh.
in what you're supposed to do about the truth,
uh-huh.
which
uh-huh.
is not typical way people look at things. That's hard to look at.
Right, right. Any? Mm-hmm. Any questions to me or to them, please? Let's just clarify.
Clarify this. Think of how your baptism service is held then, if there is no water, no word. The word is used.
There isn't a baptism service.
Mm-hmm. They do a baby dedication at our church, like.
But it's an evan, yeah.
Yes,
but they don't do it.
Yeah. Oh, certainly.
Can we talk about sacraments?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, this is something that not all friends are comfortable with either. Again, it's a point of great diversity. I serve on the board of elders at our church, and this group was brought by the pastors the question of whether we ought to make, in this case, it was the Lord's Supper, an experience of the Lord's Supper available to some members, because we have some new members who had left, given the absence of communion as the reason for their departure. It turns out, in both cases, that had been sort of a subterfuge, I guess, or a straw man. Mm-hmm. But so we deliberated over this for several months, three or four months, actually. It's one of these things where we were trying to seek consensus on that matter. Mm-hmm. And so we discussed it for at great length. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was quite an enlightening experience, because I had the advantage of the views of other friends on this. And what I discovered was that it's not so much the absence of sacraments. It's more like not merely baptism or communion, but all of life is sacramental. All those sort of experiences, those relationships that we have at a human level, those, the whole sort of corporeal universe, the everyday life, those experiences and events and objects are, if viewed properly, should be pointers to a larger reality. So that's sort of my own twist on it, but and I'm not sure that George Fox actually would look at it that way.
Well, I don't know if Fox would have. I think Woolman, whom I get to in a minute, would see that in all of, he says, God gave all life is of God, and anything living is an opportunity for interaction with the divine. Okay, and so there's a sense of, and he calls it universal love, and can see this in nature and in animals and in, plants and in one another.
It's not a particular idea either.
No.
Jonathan Edwards had this idea with his shadows and images of divine things.
Yeah, it's a
sort of
fairly
ironic too, in a way.
Yes.
But
right. But that there are people who there are some people who think that this kind of movement of the friends ultimately can point in a secular direction, because if you don't mark anything as sacred, if everything is, then if you kind of get lazy, forget it, right? So that there's a demystification and a remystification, but it can lead in that direction. One thing that's come up in several of these sessions is the influence which various religious groups have upon one another in the American context, which has so many different religious groups, and some of the technical terms that are being used: programmed, pastored meetings. Those are technical terms. In other words, there's an order of worship, not just silence. There's a person who's the pastor, not just everyone being represented of Christ there. Really, I think is proof of the strength of the evangelical movement in this country. You know, which 200 years ago, 150 years ago, 100 years ago, was changing probably the majority of Quakers in this direction. While they while some others still held to the older things. But some of the testimonies and the social witness and this basic idea of honoring the image of God in each person, I would see as consistent whether or not there's a programmed meeting or a pastored meeting or an unprogrammed meeting. Okay. Any other comments from people? Yeah, Deanne.
So one of the things that's really interesting about something like, for example, the sacraments is that the friends, on the one hand, seem to say the material is almost a temptation. You want to be careful not to depend on the material. Don't depend on the sacraments. Don't depend on some kind of visible structure. My favorite Quaker is Lucretia Mott, and she was talking about verbal idols. Don't depend on the way you say things. And yet, it is sort of wonderful paradox, a real concern that when the Spirit of God or the light is in you, that you have some impact on the material world. so that it's not a demonization of the material world, but as this man was saying, a kind of sacramentalization, but not only as a source of revelation, but as a sphere in which one acts.
That's helpful. You know, I think some of it comes out historically also out of a rage against the compromised, corrupt state churches over against which some of these Protestant movements arose. Okay, a rage over the Church of England with its, you know, its king and bishops in fancy clothing and, you know, in a specific context. And the some of the same thing with in other Protestant movements. Let me give you an example. Oh, go ahead. You've been trying to get something. Oh, I'm sorry.
These sistern families are practicing Sin, and they live in a community in Canada with a number of other people. And there, the first time I came to Holden, I said, oh, Holden ought to listen to these people because they have adopted a very much back to the earth lifestyle. And you go there and milk you. We watch, you know, milk the cows and you put it in the stream to keep it cold. You grow the vegetables in your backyard, and there are no out-and-out stores, but there is a barter system. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to make something with eggs, let's call it so-and-so. And while we have never gone to their meeting per se, to know that, you know, we see their lifestyle because we go to visit and are aware in conversation of the types of things that are of interest to them, the peace and justice issues. The youngest daughter, who just graduated from high school, while she was still in high school, she spent some summers down in one of the South American countries, Guatemala. Became very, as a Canadian, she had to learn English and French, became very influential in Spanish, and done Spanish translation. So anyway, we see their lifestyle and come to Holden and find the peace and justice issues, concerns with them.
That's interesting. I think you'll hear some echoes of this in this passage I want to give you from John Woolman. So I think there's a moral earnestness to this tradition. Okay, an effort to live simply and purely and in accordance with God's will, which sometimes it comes out in this kind of agrarian movement, sometimes it doesn't, but it can, that simplicity and earnestness of life is important. I really want to share a little piece of this. Would anybody need a window open, or is that not? Okay, I'm fine. Somebody earlier told me this room was hot. Okay. There's this wonderful pure testimony I've been describing of the early Quakers and their belief in the equality of all. But, you know, history gets messy and complex, and we live in a fallen world. This is my own Presbyterian roots coming out. We live in a fallen world anyway, even Quakers did, okay, even though they would define that differently. And by a fateful coincidence of history, this movement, born in England, middle of the 1600s, came at the same time, grew at the same time, and along the same shipping lines, along the same lines of commerce, trade, and communication as the whole Atlantic slave trade. Okay? The same ships that the Quaker missionaries were fleeing persecution or taking their message to the West Indies, for instance, to Virginia, were ships which were involved. And they weren't Quaker ships, and they were just, that's what the Atlantic world was doing at that time. The English were colonizing. Okay. The Africans were being oppressed into slavery. And it's all in the same years as the growth of the Society of Friends. Now, compared to every other Christian group, the Friends all along had a pretty good record, but not perfect. I mean, there were times when members of the society became, forgot their principles, but stayed in the society and participated in some way in the slave system, and some of them even becoming slaveholders. There was always opposition to this, but it was not thorough, it was not consistent. And as happens to so many groups who have a radical insight at the beginning, this movement also could get lazy, you know, and forget its high principles of the early years. Living simply, working hard, being virtuous, in a rapidly expanding economy for the English. A lot of them got rich, okay? Built Philadelphia, became great traders, okay? And by perhaps 100 years after the time of the founding society, there was some real compromise of its early principles. And it's in that context, in the middle of the 1700s now, that John Woolman, my favorite Quaker, arose to, in a sense, call this group of people back to its own best principles. And so often that's what prophets do. They remind, you know, the prophets in the Old Testament remind the people of Israel of their initial covenant. They're not saying something new. They're saying, remember who we are. You know, we're those people who had the covenant with Yahweh. And in a sense, that's what Woolman did. He called them back to their early, he really reflected deeply and personally on that heritage of the early Quakers and called called this people back into faithfulness to its own self, and had a major influence on it. By the end of his life, it was not acceptable to be a slaveholder and a Quaker. He was born in 1720 in New Jersey, kind of a lower middle class type person who worked as a scribe, and then as a tailor, and then as an orchard keeper, married, had a child, but mostly traveled around from meeting to meeting, usually up and down the Atlantic coast, but sometimes to England, where there were still ties, preaching and bearing testimony, entering those meetings and bringing the testimony that he had to them. And he has left, he was noted in his own time, but has also left a journal, which is a beautiful thing. I wish I had ordered it for the bookstore, I didn't. But it's a spiritual autobiography of his own journey on this pilgrimage to understanding the fullness of the Quaker heritage for himself in that time. Okay, what does this heritage have to say to this time and place in the middle of the 1700s in the United States, in what would become the United States? Let me lift up real quickly three moments of insight of his own, which will lead to the testimony I want to share. When he was a little boy, so it's on about the third page of the journal, he was playing, throwing stones at a bird, mother bird, and he hit the bird, the mother bird, and died. And he was horrified what he had done, but he decided he should kill the babies because it would be better for them not to suffer and die. And he felt miserable and remorseful about this that he had done. But what did he take from this experience? He said, and my remorse showed me that in me and in all of us, there is a tenderness, a tender-hearted love of creation, which, if we listen to it, will show us the truth. But so often it becomes distorted and we don't pay attention to it. Okay? Now, in the classical Christian tradition, an episode like that happens, and you say, and then I realized I was a horrible sinner. I stole a pear, says Augustine, you know, and he's tormented later, Augustine, you know, later on, I just can't get over this. Okay, but this instance of conscience, rather than, in a sense, showing him how bad he was, showed him that he had a moral soul, and that he was good, and that he did love creation, and that if he listened to this and went with that, that he would be free and right. Okay? And there's this image of God theme here, I think, that's very interesting. And there's that trust that if persons are enabled to listen to their true self, they will be good. And that's what they're trying, the Quakers are trying to tell all of us. Okay, a second thing. When he was a young man, probably 20 years old, working as a, he could write, and he was writing things for people who couldn't write, and he was hired to write a deed of sale of a slave. And he felt terrible about this. He hadn't thought about the issue that much. not in a slaveholding region very much, you know, but he felt horrible about this. But he did it. He told them he didn't want to do it, he was against doing it, but he did it. This one did torment him for the rest of his life as the failure. And the next time that request was made to write a will or something to do with slavery, he refused. And from thenceforth, he refused. And what I see here is a sense of the taking personally of our own little actions, no matter how unimportant we may seem to be. Taking personally the things that we do and their ethical consequences. Each one of us to see that we're morally responsible for the systems we participate in. Okay, a third indication of character early on, that he finds himself, I mean, basically, his job is too demanding for him to give ample time to God. That's why he's had all these different jobs. He's always looking for the one that's simple enough that he has time to do God's work. And he gets an offer for a big promotion, you know, and I saw the possibility of becoming well-to-do, he says. But I've noticed that whenever people get some wealth, they always want more. There's no stopping it. Okay? And so there's a sense of needing to simplify his own life in such a way that he can respond to God's call. And so he's very, he often uses the word cumbered. I didn't want to be cumbered by all that business. Or by having wealth. It takes time to manage wealth. Okay? You want to be free for God's service. So the Quaker, old Quaker testimony of plainness, for him becomes a way of talking about the simple life as a way of being available for God's work in the world. Now, as a traveling friend going from meeting to meeting, testifying often against slavery, he had to work out ways of being true to himself and bearing his testimony. And he always says, conduct is more convincing than language. So that, for instance, if he came to a place where there were slaves and he was staying the night there, he would stay there in order to testify to the slaveholders. But he would make a point of paying those who served him. You know, so as to help them and to make the witness. Okay. Things like not using any dye in clothing that might have been grown on a plantation. Just little things that would indicate his own, who he was, and so on. Well, if we put together all of these images, there's just a couple of paragraphs I want to read you that sum it up for me in a wonderful testimony. And a comment on the American experience, which is very powerful. The idea of the fundamental goodness of everyone, the image of God in all people, our own moral responsibility for what we do, and the simplicity of lifestyle is a liberating thing. Okay, this is on his journal. He has had a prompting in his heart to visit the Native Americans, to go back deeper into Pennsylvania and visit the Native Americans. And he says, why did I want to do this? Love was the first motive, he says. Love was my first motive. And thence arose a concern to spend some time with the Indians that I might feel and understand their life and the spirit they live in, and perhaps might receive some instruction from them. To find out what truth they had. There's a real willingness to learn from others. Mm-hmm. And let me read this. I might have to skip a little. He says, it's 13th of 6 months. The sun appearing, we set forward, and as I rode over the barren hills, my meditations were on the changes in the circumstances of the natives of this land since the coming in of the English. The lands near the sea are conveniently suited for fishing. The lands near the rivers where the tides flow are in many places fertile. The natives have in some places for trifling considerations sold their inheritance so favorably situated, and in other places have been driven back by superior force. He goes on how the English have led them to waste their skins and furs in purchasing liquor, which ruins them and their family, and so on. And there's a portrait of the destruction of the Native Americans by the English. My own will and desires were now very much broken, and my heart was with much earnestness turned to the Lord, to whom alone I looked for help in the dangers before me. It's at the end of the French and Indian War, and he's riding into Indian territory unarmed. I had a prospect of the English along the coast for more than 900 miles, and their favorable situation, and the difficulties attending the natives as well as the Negroes in many places were open before me. A weighty and heavenly care came over my mind, and love filled my heart towards all mankind, in which I felt a strong engagement that we might be obedient to the Lord while in tender mercy he is yet calling to us, and that we might so attend to pure universal righteousness as to give no cause of offense to the Gentiles who do not profess Christianity, whether they be the blacks from Africa or the native inhabitants of this continent. Here I was led into a close and laborious inquiry whether I, as an individual, kept clear from all things which tended to stir up or were connected with wars, either in this land or in Africa. My heart was deeply concerned that in future I might in all things keep steadily to the pure truth and live and walk in the plainness and simplicity of a sincere follower of Christ. In this long journey, I did greatly bewail the spreading of a wrong spirit, believing that the prosperous, convenient situation of the English would require of them constant attention to divine love and wisdom, in order that they would be guided and supported in a way answerable to the will of that good, gracious, and almighty being who hath an equal regard to all mankind. And here luxury and covetousness, with the numerous oppressions and other evils attending them, appeared very afflicting to me, and I felt in that which is immutable that the seeds of great calamity and desolation are sown and growing fast on this continent. The seeds of great calamity and desolation are sown and growing fast on this continent. Nor have I words sufficient to set forth the longing I then felt that we who are placed along the coast, the white population, and have tasted the love and goodness of God, might arise in the strength of that love and goodness, and like faithful messengers labor to check the growth of these seeds, that they may not ripen to the ruin of our posterity. Did you get the basic points there? The way in which this basically a lot of the tragedies of the American history are being seen in spiritual dimension, which has to do with our own moral accountability and a strong spiritual sense of God's love for all humankind. And some real efforts to check the growth of those seeds, though they were stronger than the Quakers could themselves overcome. Comments or
responses? You know the book, The Testament of Devotion? It's my very beloved book.
By?
I can't pull the name from my...
Thomas Kelly.
Kelly?
Thomas Kelly. It just occurred to me, I moved a year ago, and hundreds of books went, and that was one of my very special. I have many friends that are Quakers, uh-huh. and I've been a close adherent of the uh-huh. Quaker Church.
Thank you. I'll look for it. Other comments on this?
I'm wondering I understand the what I would call evangelism, but I wonder how much would I be welcome to visit. Would I be welcome to attend
Quaker Church?
Quaker Church
or
a meeting?
A meeting.
Well, the meeting, yeah. Uh-huh. Either one would just open
yeah.
A
meeting.
Yeah.
Yes. There's a man who's a member of our congregation, which is a Lutheran congregation, Christian congregation, who also attends Quaker meeting. He goes to Quaker meeting, and then he comes to our worship service. And our worship service is very noisy and disruptive and has children running back and forth all the time, and I always wonder how this man can live in two worlds, but he seems to mm-hmm. want to do that. Mm-hmm. So, sure, you can look.
I want did this quote come across to you as a, I mean, I think this is a wonderful passage, and I don't know if reading it is effective, but it's something I really like sharing with people.
Can I second your endorsement of John Holman's journal? Mm-hmm. I'm currently reading it again. It's one of those things I return to mm-hmm. a lot, and Holman is one of my heroes. In January, when the U.S. invaded Kuwait, the war began, we began to, Quakers, Eugene, and others of the historic French peace churches, the Brethren and Mennonites, gathered and began to enact some events, sort of mourning the war and laying out our testimony against warfare. But what I found interesting was that Woolman's works began to be brought up over and over again. And the expression that I found myself using a lot was the phrase that he used, the seeds of war. Mm-hmm. And he found himself, that was his image, I think, for that. And he used seed in a positive sense, too. He used, Quakers often have used seed, too, as kind of image of Christ within each person. But in this sense,